The more they can walk above the surface of the water, the better chance they're going to have as water fills those spaces.
More boys are successfully rescued from a Thailand cave. It's Tuesday, July 10th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, diplomacy and challenges with North Korea. China and the United States trade tariffs. Australia blames Vietnamese gangs for drugs. Tracking Arctic mammals, creating water from thin air. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Rescuers in Thailand extracted four more boys from a flooded cave Monday to bring the total rescue to eight, as efforts continue to save the remaining members of a soccer team and their coach who have been trapped underground since June 23rd. Rescue operations have stopped for the day in Thailand. They'll resume in just a short time as monsoon rains have started falling again, causing water levels inside the cave to rise. Arash Arabasadi has more in this report.
The rescue of four more boys Monday took place as volunteers and first responders race against time to save the remaining members of a youth soccer team and their coach. After their rescue, the boys were rushed to a nearby hospital where doctors are keeping them under observation. The Thai mission commander says the boys at the hospital are well, but hungry.
This morning they said they were hungry and asked for Krapao rice, but they still need to be kept away from their parents and others due to fear of infection.
The rescue operation has so far moved at a pace of four per day following Sunday's break to replenish air tanks and give divers rest. Duke Speed, a former U.S. Marine, spent much of his career working in amphibious reconnaissance. An expert in confined space and high-risk diving operations, he says the rescue challenges both the diver and those stranded.
You're looking at 2.5 miles of confined space, low light conditions, and all the equipment considerations, as well as the physical effects on the divers and, you know, all the rescue forces and the boys themselves.
Rescue teams have so far succeeded in pumping water from the cave, but forecasters warn that monsoon rains are falling and could further complicate rescue efforts.
The ideal situation is to have less water. The more they can walk above the surface of the water, the better chance they're going to have as water fills those spaces. Now that that adds the factor that you have to put the boys on compressed air and actually in a true diving situation.
The rescue operation has already claimed the life of one Thai Navy SEAL who drowned Friday on his return swim after dropping air tanks along the escape route in the cave. With four boys and their coach still underground, the race against the elements keeps pressure high for a speedy extraction when rescue efforts resume on Tuesday. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Forrest Wilson, a diving officer with the U.S.-based National Cave Rescue Commission, explains to VOA's Victor Beatty the difficulties of getting out of that cave, but thankfully, all of the journey is not spent underwater.
There are several places that they have to actually dive, but a lot of it's they're swimming on the surface.
How much of it is diving? How can those oxygen tanks support them for how long?
So that's the point. If they had to swim that whole way, they couldn't carry enough oxygen. The longest sump that I've seen is 30 meters, around a little less than 100 feet. The others are shorter, so that there's not a whole lot of time spent totally under the water.
Can they get down and back on one tank, or does it take two tanks?
Probably it takes two.
And are they able to navigate around these narrow passageways with those tanks, I assume, attached to their backs?
No, they don't attach them to their backs. They wear them on their side. It's a British thing, sump diving thing. And if necessary, they can take one off or both off and push them in front of them. Having seen some of the drawings of the passageway, it's not exceedingly small. It's a little bit small to wear them on their sides in the normal manner, but it's not a terribly small passageway.
What are the conditions that have to be prepared for when you're traveling such a long distance? Is 4 kilometers a very long distance for divers to go?
Well, we do it all the time in Florida, but conditions are worse there because of the current and the visibility is not very good.
What are the prospects, you think, of getting the rest of them out?
If they don't wait too long and the monsoons come, it's real good. From what I understand, they've taken the weakest boys out first, so the others should be stronger, should have less problems.
If they're unaccustomed to these diving conditions, these young boys, what are they feeling? What kind of training would they be given before they're donned with the necessary equipment to get out?
Now, they can't be very claustrophobic or they've never gone in there. But as far as training, they tried to train them with the normal diving gear, you know, regulator and a tank. Apparently, they didn't do well, so they're using a full face mask. A full face mask doesn't take as much training. However, they're prone to leaking, and if you bump them on the cave wall and flood them, I'm not sure the boys would know how to deal with that. So that is one danger.
And so they're perhaps maybe taking them just a short distance at a time?
Yes, and they've got a diver in front, the diver in the back. The boys are tethered to the divers. One of the divers holding the bottle, the oxygen, the air bottle that is supplying that full face mask.
And how long do you think this process would take, given the length they have to go?
A good diver is going to take about 5 hours to get out of there. So these aren't good divers, so you figure it's going to be over 5 hours, possibly six.
As the story continues to develop, follow along at VOA Asia Facebook. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. 8 boys rescued from flooded Thai cave. Trump confident North Korea will honor contract to denuclearize. U.S. and Vietnam to cooperate on freedom of navigation in disputed South China Sea. Bangladesh begins registering Rohingya refugees. China lawyer crackdown enters fourth year. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find them on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, after meeting Sunday in Tokyo with his Japanese and South Korean counterparts, remained upbeat but realistic following 2 days of talks with North Korean officials in Pyongyang, his first since the Singapore summit last month between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Pompeo also said international sanctions will remain in place until denuclearization is realized. And during a brief stop in Hanoi, the secretary urged North Korea to follow the example of Vietnam, once a bitter U.S. enemy, by embracing normalized relations. After Pompeo left North Korea, the state-run KCNA blasted his visit for its, quote, gangster-like demands for unilateral nuclear disarmament that it called regrettable and could undermine its commitment to denuclearization. VOA's Victor Beatty joins us again, this time with RAND Corporation senior defense analyst Bruce Bennett, who says while North Korea is known to take extreme positions, it has repeatedly committed itself to denuclearization.
They clearly agreed in April to complete denuclearization. If you read item 1.1 of the April 27th declaration between President Moon and Kim Jong-un, it says North and South Korea will implement all previous declarations and agreements. And one of those was the 1992 denuclearization agreement that for both the North and the South, they would have zero nuclear weapons, zero uranium enrichment, zero plutonium reprocessing, zero nuclear weapon production capability. Kim agreed to that in April. He agreed to it again in June when the item 3 in June says, with the spirit of the April 27th agreement, we will fully denuclearize. So twice now he's agreed to it. For him to back away from that, that's reneging.
Some analysts, lawmakers, are expressing concern. The talks appear to have run into difficulty. Is North Korea again dragging this out while they continue pursuing weapons of mass destruction?
Oh, absolutely, yes. If you look at North Korean production capacity, it is highly likely that since January, they've probably produced 5 or 6 nuclear weapons. They've produced ballistic missiles. So North Korea is not denuclearizing. It's not even freezing its nuclear forces. It's nuclearizing. I mean, Kim is being a hypocrite. Is this a bait and switch by North Korea, by Kim Jong-un, to get President Trump to come to a summit meeting with him? Could be. But I think the administration simply needs to go back and say, look, you've already agreed to this. We don't need to pay you anything for this.
Richard Hawes of the Council on Foreign Relations said on Twitter there was a danger of military action because President Trump might now claim he tried diplomacy, but he was betrayed by Kim.
Absolutely. I mean, President Trump went out of his way to cut a deal with Kim Jong-un and do almost everything Kim wanted. He was really very accommodating. If Kim now reneges, then he's given President Trump a reasonable basis to say, look, I tried. Kim won't negotiate. He's lying to us. Nobody wants North Korea to fall into a war with us. But on the other hand, nobody wants North Korea to have a couple hundred nuclear weapons and 50 ICBMs in 2030.
Do you see China behind North Korea's recent truculence?
To a certain extent, yes, because the mechanism that the U.S. has used to try to convince North Korea to follow the U.N. Security Council resolutions has been economic sanctions. And certainly since roughly the March timeframe, China has been loosening the economic sanctions that it had previously implemented.
Bruce Bennett said while Vietnam never possessed nuclear weapons, the analogy is clear. Kim Jong-un has the opportunity to improve conditions in his country if he chooses to be consistent with past commitments. Happening now in Asia, Japan is trying to cope with the worst flood disaster since 1983. The death toll has risen to at least 114 people as rising water is forcing millions to leave their homes. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has canceled planned overseas visits to remain at home and oversee the government's response. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. The opening shots have been fired in what some fear may be the start of a major trade war. China retaliating at midnight Friday with equivalent tariffs on U.S. goods after the U.S. followed through on its threat to raise tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese imports. Millar Sega explains the developments as the U.S. job market posted solid gains last month.
Friday brought a mixed bag of economic news. On the one hand, stronger than expected hiring by U.S. companies last month, overshadowed by the start of a trade war with potentially serious consequences for the world's two largest economies.
The Chinese government will take out its wrath on the U.S. multinationals operating on Chinese soil by instituting all sorts of new regulations, increasing taxes, cutting off supply lines, not allowing certain employees to be hired by the U.S. operations in China.
But it could also lead to casualties in China, says former U.S. Trade Representative Stephen Land.
China has a lot more at stake than the United States in this negotiation. We will be harmed. We could be certainly with some dislocation. But the Chinese economy is not that strong internally. They can't take a battle with the U.S.
President Donald Trump says it's a battle worth fighting to address the huge U.S. trade deficit with China, which has ballooned over the last 10 years to more than $375 billion. British investment manager James Bevan agrees with Mr. Trump, saying the trade imbalance has led to factory closures and job losses in the U.S.
He knows and understands in a very visceral sense the challenges that face the American people. And I suspect that he will continue to push the agenda of better conditions and better outcomes for American workers.
But the consequences of a trade war are likely to be worse than the problem Mr. Trump wants to solve, says Bankrate's Mark Hamrick on Skype.
I really see the threat of trade disputes and those that are actually occurring as having two simple basic impacts on individuals, and that is higher prices, inflation, as well as slowing growth. And that is not only for the United States, that's a global impact.
Business interests in both China and the U.S. are hoping cooler heads will prevail. But with the U.S. also at odds with its trading partners in Europe, Canada, and Mexico, trade experts say the continued posturing and the back-and-forth threats could depress business and consumer confidence, potentially erasing the improving employment picture and years of economic gains. Millar Sega for VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, gangs in Vietnam getting the blame in Australia. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, 5 people missing after a ferry accident in Phuket, Thailand, are reported to be alive. Authorities say 12 people remain missing following last week's accident that left some 42 people dead. The boat was filled with 93 Chinese tourists when it was hit by a 5-meter wave. VOA 60 has more on this story online. Also visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Vietnamese crime gangs are being blamed for the illicit production of cannabis in suburban houses across Australia. The authorities say small residential drug factories grow more marijuana in Australia than any other method. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
The cultivation of cannabis in so-called grow houses in Australia is far more widespread than police had previously thought. Investigators say that organised gangs run by Vietnamese criminals are at the heart of a multi-billion dollar illicit trade. It's alleged that the crime syndicates are luring young Vietnamese to mine the crops. They would typically travel to Australia on a student or tourist visa with the promise of earning several thousand dollars. Superintendent Peter McElane from the New South Wales State Drug and Firearms Squad says cannabis cultivation is part of a web of illicit drug trafficking.
The cannabis grow houses, the profits that they make from there can fuel, you know, other illegal activities, and that could mean importing, you know, other drugs through the border, manufacturing other drugs, including ice, importing cocaine or heroin through the border. That's the potential danger. Generally, is that channeling that profit to other illegal activities.
It's estimated that a single residential property can generate a profit of $185,000 in just 3 months. Investigators say they simply don't know how many cannabis grow houses there are in Australia. Raids are regularly carried out by the police, but Gus Vieira, the commander of Strike Force Zambezi, believes the illegal industry continues to grow.
As much as we are having a result, I don't know whether we're actually making a dent into it or not, because we could be disrupting one here today and another 4 or 5 could be popping up.
The Australian government has estimated there are more than 2,300 Vietnamese who have overstayed their visas and are currently in Australia illegally. It's thought many could be involved with the cannabis trade. The Department of Home Affairs deported 380 Vietnamese nationals in 2016-17. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia, a judge in Myanmar has ruled that 2 Reuters journalists will be tried for allegedly breaking the country's laws by reporting on the Rohingya refugee crisis. The U.S. State Department says the case is a step backward for press freedom and raises questions about the rule of law in Myanmar. Top stories from Asia are on VOA 60 and VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the polar bear may be the classic poster child for climate change, but it's far from the only animal threatened by a warming Arctic. Because the region is warming 2 to 3 times more quickly than the rest of the planet, the rapidly melting sea ice is opening new shipping lanes. Sadie Witkowski has found new research is suggesting increased vessel traffic through the Arctic waters is putting narwhals and other animals at risk.
Maritime traffic is dramatically increasing in the relatively untouched Arctic Ocean as receding sea ice clears the historically dangerous Northwest Passage and the Northern Sea Route along Russia's northern coast. The effect on the fragile ecosystem caught the attention of Donna Hauser from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
We're on the precipice. We're poised for a lot of vessel traffic to increase in the Arctic. And so part of what motivated this study is to understand where we're at and where we need to go.
the marine biologist was interested in assessing the vulnerability of Arctic marine mammals to shipping activity to protect both the species and the people who rely on them.
All of these species are really important traditional resources for the indigenous communities throughout the Arctic, as well as in Alaska and the Alaskan Arctic in particular.
Hauser and her co-authors looked at 7 Arctic species, including seals, whales, and polar bears. They created a vulnerability measure based on a combination of the animal's exposure to shipping traffic and its general sensitivity. They limited their assessment to September, when the sea ice is at its lowest point and most ships pass through Arctic waters. Their research found that narwhals and other whale species were the most vulnerable to late summer ship traffic, and polar bears were the least. Co-author Kristen Lydra of the Polar Ice Institute explained why narwhals and other cetaceans are especially affected.
Ships, in general, generate underwater noise, and that underwater noise is a disturbance for marine mammals, especially different whale species that rely on sound to pretty much do everything.
Narwhals in particular are at risk because of a combined effect of their high exposure and sensitivity. This puts the so-called unicorns of the sea in the most perilous position of all the Arctic marine mammals, with other whales facing similar but less extreme circumstances. Polar bears, on the other hand, seem to be the best equipped to deal with the late summer vessel traffic.
At that time of year, polar bears tend to be either on land or they've followed the pack ice north.
Hauser pointed to a second reason the bears were less vulnerable.
They don't use sound in the same way as the other marine mammals do.
This is the first study to compare effects of increased ship traffic across the major Arctic marine mammal species and determine which might be most in need of conservation efforts. In order to help protect these sentinel species, and whales in particular, the authors suggest requiring ships to move at slower speeds to reduce collisions with whales. By understanding which marine mammals are at risk, researchers can help plan for an uncertain future. Sadie Witkowski, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists have developed a way to harvest water from dry desert air, and the only power the device needs is sunlight. That could be very useful in an increasingly water-stressed world. VOA's Steve Barragona fills us in.
Even the driest desert air has some moisture in it. The trick is how to capture it. That's exactly what happens inside this box, says University of California, Berkeley graduate student Eugene Capiston.
The key component of this device is this powder. We call it metaorganic framework.
What's remarkable about this unremarkable-looking powder is its molecular structure.
Within this framework, there is empty space where molecules of gas, such as water vapor, can get inside and stay there. So you can imagine it's like a sponge.
Leave a box of it out overnight to soak up moisture from the desert air, then seal it up in a plexiglass container and leave it out in the sun. As the sun heats up the powder, water starts to escape and fog up the plexiglass, says UC Berkeley graduate student Farad Fatieh.
We see the fog formation about after 30 minutes to an hour. Then the fog formed on the side walls. They're getting bigger and bigger, and the droplets forms. And once the droplets get bigger and bigger, so they drop and falls down to the bottom of the water harvester.
What comes out is pure, fresh drinking water.
Cheers.
Each kilogram of powder can make about 175 milliliters of water, about one small glass. A bigger box makes more water. The team is working on boosting the yield. But the simple design means it works off the grid, says UC Berkeley chemistry professor Omar Yagi.
So this is all run under ambient sunlight, no electric being supplied into the box at all. So this can work out in the desert where there is no supply of energy aside from sunlight.
Tests in the Arizona desert showed it worked best when angled toward the sun and insulated with soil. Yagi says a commercial product may be ready in 2 to 3 years. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. And, of course, we're streaming every day on VOA Asia Facebook and at our website, voanews.com. That's maybe how you're listening right now. Or perhaps you're listening on the radio. Falcon Radio, Adamson University in the Philippines carries our program. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. And, of course, we've got to thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zineb Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you enjoy your day.